Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips and PC. It is Saturday, the 23rd of July, Anno Domini 2011, and you hot but lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm sorry, I'm Steve Ray. I'm waiting for that Dave Enright. Right?
And I'm Linda Wildman.
And we're going to be bringing you...
I standing there, but I still waited for him to
Yeah, there's very few people who would confuse Linda and Dave. We're going to be bringing you all kinds of interesting stuff. As you can see, Dave Enright is one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest. Good luck, Dave. Yeah, he's probably on the motorcycle, so he'll be fine. He'll be ahead of the law, not a problem. All right, let's start with the news. You can give us a call, of course, at 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Steve is still setting up the camera, so those of you who are not seeing us on the Ustream, get over yourselves, we'll be there in a minute. A quick-witted Google engineer has uncovered evidence that as many as 1 million Windows PCs appear to have been hit by browser redirection malware that is sending searches through proxy servers in order to generate hit traffic. This type of attack has been around for years in one form or another, but the scale of what Google engineer Damian Mensher chanced upon from a single family of malware is still unusual in its scale. Performing routine maintenance on a data center, Mensher noticed unusual traffic still arriving at the servers from unusual addresses. Calling in help from security experts, it was discovered that the requests were coming from a large clutch of PCs infected by proxy redirection malware. Google has now added a layer of detection that picks up on the redirection attack and gives its victims a search page message. Your computer appears to be infected if traffic through the proxies is noticed. We hope that by taking steps to notify users whose traffic is coming through these proxies, we can help them update their antivirus software and remove the infections, Google said in an official blog. For anyone in doubt, the symptoms of this type of attack are easy to spot, although not always easy for a user to clean up. When making Google searches, users are sent to any one of a variety of unrelated sites for porn, malware, fake antivirus, or cloned products. That points to the limitations of Google's action. It tells affected users they have a problem, but can't do anything directly about it. Google doesn't mention which malware is associated with the issue, but Mensher said that he believed a fairly standard fake AV scareware campaign was the most likely culprit. That would explain the large number of users that appear to have been affected. Of course, the easiest fix for you is if you get this message is to dance the security tango. Our question to you at our local... at our website, soundbites.org.
The camera's not on yet.
Oh, good. That's Bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. Did you get hit? Actually, it'll only say, did you get hit by the search redirection virus? Your choices, of course, are yes, no, and I am willfully ignorant of the problem and the solution. The vast majority of you so far, we have 38 votes, said no. The next largest group is willfully ignorant of the problem and the solution. How sad for you. And so far, nobody says they've been hit, or at least won't admit it. When you are done with that, however, I know you will have more to say on this subject. So if you check the yellow box underneath the poll and click on Give Us Your Opinion, it will take you to another website where, in fact, you can enter your opinion. So far, we've got about three people doing that. Now, this is only a... only a Windows virus, but the question is, were you hit by the search redirection virus, and what did you do? And, of course, that's our question to you. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415, just like Chris did from Colorado Springs. Chris, is this Colorado Springs, Colorado?
Yes, this is traveling Jazz member Chris from normally Gates, but I'm in Colorado Springs on my way to Denver.
Cool. You got to go to Cheyenne Mountain and look at the Stargate.
Yeah.
Okay.
I called last week and I signed up for the 3G on my iPad because I was traveling and I knew my niece here wasn't going to have Wi-Fi. But my question to you is, while I'm here, I'm trying to send pictures like I normally do via Wi-Fi on my iPad, and normally they just instantaneously go out.
Yeah.
It's taken forever over this 3G, and I wondered if that's the case.
Yeah, that's completely normal, I'm afraid. The problem is the speed of 3G.
There could also be an issue before that. Who is your email provider that you're sending the messages with?
Well, I'm through a college, so it would be micro.
Okay, they're probably set up for remote mail. What happens a lot of times is from Rochester here, if you're using Frontier or Time Warner, when you go to someone else's internet and try to send a mail using your normal Roadrunner mail settings, it won't go because you're not connected to Roadrunner. So that can be
Microsoft Outlook, I guess it would be.
Well, that's the program you're using. What's your email provider?
Yeah, are you doing this? Are you trying to send these as email or just upload them to somewhere?
No, they're uploaded to my iPad, but then once they're on my iPad, I just hit the email link and I send them out.
And what email address are you using to send them from?
My college address from Rochester.
And you're set up for your college email servers?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's probably not the issue then, but
this is a good question, and what I need to ask you is, have you been able to send out regular email?
Always Wi-Fi, no problem.
I'm talking about now that you're on 3G.
Yes, it sends out regular, yes, without the pictures.
Okay, so
but
then...
I haven't noticed if it took longer or not, because I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, it will take longer, but with text messages, it's probably not noticeably longer. But once you're sending pictures, which are larger, it is noticeably slower sending email.
Okay,
your 3G connection is probably...
the case.
Yeah, your 3G connection is probably, 500K upload at best?
At best.
And you know, when you're connected to normal Wi-Fi on a landline, you're probably getting 1,000K or more.
So it really would behoove me to find some free Wi-Fi out here and then try to send my pictures that way. It wouldn't take quite as long.
Yeah, most of the time your 3G customers will see anywhere from about 50K
Yeah,
3G. To about 1.5 megabits per second.
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is that you're using your 3G data allowance. So if you signed up for 2 gigabytes of data, which is 2,000 megs, and you send a 10-meg picture, you can only send 100 of those, and there's 1,000 megs already.
I did notice they're about 3 megabytes, the pictures, as they're going through.
Yeah. Right. So they are going to take a longer time. I actually... I had exactly that same experience the other day. I took a picture on the Asus Transformer tablet, and it was immediately available on the web. And then I took a picture the next day with a phone, and it took 20 minutes.
Okay.
So it can and in fact, that probably would have been longer.
And some of that's the difference between 3G and 4G, too.
Well,
4G is significantly faster if your device has it and you're in a city that has 4G service, which aren't that many yet.
Right. And also, I happened to, at that point, have all four bars.
Yep.
When I was uploading my little 3G pictures. So if you have not a full set of bars and you're on 3G, it can take quite a while, depending on the size of the picture, to upload it.
Okay, I just wondered. In fact, I had sent them, and as I mentioned last week, I was turning off the cellular when I wasn't using it, only to find out while I turned it off, and of course, the pictures hadn't even been emailed yet, which I wasn't thinking was happening because normally it's instantaneous.
So fast, yeah. You got to wait for that whoosh when the email finishes sending.
Yeah, so it's taken quite a while. But I appreciate the information and know that everything's good then. And like I said, it's my first opportunity using the 3G with the iPad.
How hot is it in Colorado Springs?
Well, we're heading up to Denver here, and it's only 84. We did Pikes Peak yesterday, and up there it was only 53 degrees up at 14,000 elevation. So, but we haven't got quite the heat. I hear you guys are having back there.
No, it's only 86 today, so we're all we've got coats on, and we're in our parkas. Linda's freezing.
88 outside, it says.
Oh, is it 88 now? Still. Now I may take off that top layer. All right.
Yeah, but we're 2 hours behind, but thanks a lot, guys, and you guys have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too, Chris. Enjoy that iPad on 3G.
Yeah, it's only 10 o'clock there, so you know they're not even into the heat of the afternoon yet.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Colorado Springs, Colorado. Very, very cool.
We used to...
Go ahead.
The TV show Stargate takes place at Cheyenne Mountain at Colorado Springs, and they always show the front gate as their establishing shot when they're going to show a scene inside the mountain. And so we look up the Cheyenne Mountain public information officer, and they used to give tours, and there were pictures of cheerleaders and football stars, and people would go to Cheyenne Mountain to get their picture in front of this giant Cheyenne Mountain complex sign and all the armed guards and security.
By tours, you mean up to the front gate?
I think they let you inside the gate, but not too far down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they've actually cut back a lot on the tours with the security concerns lately.
Yeah, I bet.
Because it is a working military base with, I think Space Guard is still at Cheyenne Mountain.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yep.
I've been playing with 3G and 4G and wireless and everything else, and it's been pretty astonishing, actually, the difference in speed. We get awfully easily used to the speed that we have here, but it's still not. What the heck was that? All right, here we go. Our next caller is Jim from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
I just got a problem with getting on the internet here. I got a Dell and had to reload the software. Kids don't have any virus protection. I brought it over to my house. Same kind of connection with a Roadrunner. And just put another hard drive in it and reloaded Windows. And I got to the first step in it. I can't get it on the internet. And I went... and loaded Ubuntu as a secondary operating system, it goes right to the internet, just plays like world champion.
It sounds like you need the driver for your Ethernet card in Windows.
Often.
That's what it looks like to me, too, but yeah. I can't get it to work. It gives me that question mark on the, I've forgotten where it is now.
You have to put in the driver disk for the Ethernet card to be able to load that driver.
I put in every disk I got.
Do you have one that says Ethernet driver on it?
I got all the factory disks. None of the factory disks work.
So then that becomes a problem because you have to go on the internet to download the driver, and you can't get on the internet because your driver doesn't work.
Well, if you've still got Ubuntu loaded.
Yeah, on another machine.
What you can do is go to the Dell website and put in the serial number of that Dell. And it will show you a list of all the drivers that are available for that model. The problem is, even if you told me the model number and the type and everything else, Dell tends to use whatever parts are handy. Now, they keep a real good list of those parts, but I can't tell you what particular driver you would need for that particular machine.
Sometimes,
but Dell can.
Sometimes you even have to open the machine and look at the card because you'll get to that Dell website and it says if you have this NIC, you download this driver. If it's this one, you download the other driver. If it's version 1, you download this. If it's version 3, you download that.
And our Chandra on the IRC chat reminds me it's the service tag, not the serial number. Thank you very much.
Okay. And the other thing I was going to say is it's got no card in it.
There's
on the motherboard. You know, it's one of those kind of things that everything's built into this.
Well, that's still.
I have another machine identical. I bought them about a month apart, and I've switched back and forth to try to get that driver and load it on there, and nothing seems to work.
Well, like I said, they may use different drivers because they may be different revisions of the motherboard.
Okay, gotcha.
Dell is inexpensive in part because they use whatever's available today.
Okay.
So you really need to go online, put in the service tag number, and they will tell you exactly what driver you need. Make sure you download the one for the correct operating system, whether you've put XP or Windows 7 or whatever on it. But that's the problem. Ubuntu found the driver it needed because it keeps a fairly comprehensive list of them nowadays. But Windows does not. They assume that you are going to have the right driver handy, and if you don't, too bad.
Okay, well, thanks for helping me. One other little thing is, how do you shut off a McAfee scan if you need to use your computer? It's slowing everything down, but right now I need to use a computer, and I don't have time for this. Can I get in there and shut that off and then turn it back on?
There should be a cancel scan button.
Okay. Yeah.
You should be able to...
Nothing shows up. It's all in the background.
Well, right, but you should have somewhere under Start, there should be the McAfee stuff.
While the scan is running, you should see the icon in the system tray also.
Right, in the system tray is the icon. You should be able to turn the scan off there.
I never checked the Start button. I'll do that. Well, thanks for helping me.
Okay, good luck.
I've been a member a couple of years. I get to listen to you every Saturday, but I usually have to work. I'm drive, so I can't call you. But thanks for helping me.
Well, I'm glad you're listening. Thanks a lot, Jim. That's what we love, people who listen. Even if they can't call in, we do love to have them listen. Linda prefers it when they don't call in because...
It's working!
The phones are working, yeah.
The phones are working. Linda did have a little trouble last time. It was not her fault. We're not going to say that.
Let us road you have to go on to get to Cheyenne Mountain.
I know.
That's the thing you normally see.
It's very sinuous.
Don't call it Cheyenne Mountain for nothing.
Right. That's one of the things about Dell. They, you know, everybody loves Dells partially because they're inexpensive. One of the things that makes them inexpensive is they use a variety of parts, depending on what they've got on hand today. One of the things that we always say is that you should buy locally, and there's really two reasons for that. Three. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. One is you keep your money local. Two is you really do have a face to look at when there's a problem. And the third is because you have a face to look at, all the reputable dealers in town try to use higher-end components so that you don't have this kind of trouble. So you may pay something comparable to what you pay with Dell, maybe even a tiny bit more, but a machine that lasts you 2 years longer is not necessarily a bad trade-off for that little bit of extra money. Now, there are a lot of you out there who build your own machines, and I do get that. But for those of you who don't, you're probably best off going with a local reputable dealer, getting exactly what you need, and then knowing exactly what's in that machine and being able to take it locally to someone who exactly knows how to fix that machine. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray and the redoubtable Linda Wildman, who has graciously stood in for Dave, who's one step ahead of the law in the Midwest. I'm Nick Francesco. Back in just a couple of minutes on Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. How very wonderful this music is. It's very inspiring. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
And at 22 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. All right. As promised, for those of you who've been hiding under a rock and don't know this, Apple let Mac OS X Lion out of its cage on Wednesday. That's probably one of about 100 billion people who put it that way. Versatile version 10.7 of the operating system has more than 250 new features, Apple said, but an installation disk isn't one of them. It's available for $30. $29.99 is $30 as a 3.5 gigabyte download only. Apple enjoys pushing the computer industry into 4 gigabytes.
Four and a half. Yeah,
I must have mistyped, and I apologize for that. 4.5 gigabytes.
Yep.
Like that. Well, that's
because normally OSs are released on DVD.
Yeah, Apple enjoys pushing the computing industry into the future by dropping technology it deems to be from the past. For example, floppy disks missing from the first iMac, and those who want a real world copy of the OS will have to wait until Apple releases it on a USB thumb drive next month for $70. The Mac OS X download available through the Mac App Store dovetails with Apple's new MacBook Air and Mac Mini Lion-based computers. These new models are updated with Intel's modern Sandy Bridge processors and a high-speed Thunderbolt data transfer port, and none has a DVD drive for the next OS upgrade. One new feature in Lion is a range of multi-touch gestures that let people control on-screen content with their fingers. In addition, the platform lets applications run in full-screen mode, something Windows users are accustomed to. Apple updated its approach to managing multitasking with Mission Control, which provides a glimpse into all the programs running on the Mac. The operating system's launchpad feature helps to quickly access and launch applications from the operating system. Lion's versions feature automatically saves people's work and allows them to go back to different versions of a file. A new resume feature lets users get back to where they left off with their applications after the Mac has been shut down and restarted, similar to how some web browsers can launch by reopening the tabs a person has been using. Mac OS X is also the first version of Apple's operating system to come with the Mac App Store built in. The marketplace launched in January as a download for Snow Leopard users. So our question to you, did you install Lion? What do you think? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
Did you see Joya Tech with some of Lion's less known gestures?
Yeah, yeah. did you notice that all the hoopla, if not the kerfuffle going on the web about the fact that apparently scrolling is now backwards?
Well, it's iOS scrolling. When you move your finger down on an iPad or even on the tablets, the web page moves down. On your computer, when you click the down arrow, the text on screen moves up. So it's been backwards all along, and now it's right.
No, it's just been... Yeah, for those of you who are iOS-centric, which, of course, leads us to when are we going to see the Mac Chromebook, that is to say, a MacBook of some sort.
It's called the iPad.
No, that has a keyboard and everything else and runs an iOS-like operating system that just brings you, because they're going with iCloud or up there or whatever the hell's going to be called, that's coming. And once Apple has their own cloud, they're going to start expecting people to store stuff in it. We're already seeing that the products don't have a lot of RAM in them.
Yeah.
And so, or a lot of disk space, rather. So I think that we're going to see that coming, and eventually we'll see, you know, all the people who've been poo-pooing the Chromebook are going to be saying the same thing about the iOS book, you know, or the opposite, because they are Mac fans, and whatever Steve Jobs says is okay by them. All right, our next caller is Dennis from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dennis. What's your question?
Well, I'm online looking at a turntable from Amazon.com, and it doesn't say anything about being able to rip your vinyl or whatever you call it. It says you can connect it directly to your computer. Why do I need a turntable that has USB if this thing says I can connect it directly to my computer? Couldn't I get Audacity and do something with
it? There's two ways to connect the turntable to your computer. One is you can use the line jacks that look like the typical RCA plugs you'd see on the back of a stereo, but then you need those RCA jacks on your computer, and that's very rare.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is over USB. So you plug it into your USB port on your computer, and then the computer sees it as a USB device. And then Audacity is the software half of it, a nice free open source program to do capture the audio that the turntable is playing. So you can use a regular turntable with regular RCA jacks on it, but then quite often you need an amplifier in order to get high enough volume out of the turntable in your computer.
Okay, this says switchable preamp.
So it has a preamp built into it.
And it says dual RCA female to 3.5 millimeter mini plug male stereo adapter
cable. So it has a 3.5 plug. So your computer would need to have a 3.5-inch line input jack on it. And if you have that, you're set. If you don't have that, then you need a USB turntable.
I see. Okay. Could I get an adapter that would adapt to the smaller plugins on the computer from the big plugins, I guess?
You have something smaller than 3.5? That's the standard mini stereo jack.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what but don't I have a line in on my computer or something?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, no. You may, but not necessarily.
I see. But if I do, I can just do this and get the Audacity and...
Right. The microphone in is not a line in.
Okay.
It's an entirely different connection.
Some computers have one, some have the other, some have both, some have neither. It completely depends on what your computer has on it.
Okay, well, that's easy to check out. But it's not an absolute that you need to have a turntable with USB.
No, right. It's just that for many machines, that's the only way you're going to get
them connected. In fact, if you have an existing stereo system with a turntable already on it, you can use that. You can use a line.
If you've got the line
right.
in.
Right, have a line out on the back of the stereo to the line in on your computer. Not many people have turntables left anymore.
Exactly.
Except the true audiophiles who wouldn't want to digitize it anyway.
Right.
Well, my turntable went went kaput many, many years ago, but I have like a couple of hundred LPs that I'd like to do something with.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure, no problem.
I actually have one of those myself. I think it's from Ion.
Yeah, I've got the Ion USB. All the advertisements say it has a direct drive belt from the motor to the turntable. One of the guys in our users group got mad because he opened his up, and it's a rubber band.
Yeah, what did he expect it to be?
That's a direct drive belt.
What did he expect it to be?
Well, because over time it's going to stretch out, and then your thing won't spin right anymore.
Yes. What did he expect?
That's what happens.
That's what a direct drive belt does, always has done. Yep.
I've also seen several different brands of turntables that have a CD recorder built in, where it's a self-contained unit. You put a blank CD in, you put your album on it, and it burns it itself.
Yep.
It's many hundreds of dollars, but it does it itself.
Right. All right, our next caller is Lou from Fairport. Welcome, Lou. What's your question?
Thanks, guys, for taking my call. It's probably a dumb question, but I think I fried the computer. My power went out. The computer went down. I don't have a surge protector, unfortunately. And I tried to turn it back on. It goes to the Windows screen where it starts up. The bar's flashing on the bottom, and then it says monitor turning off, and there's no sound from the tower. So.
Oh, yeah.
Probably it's done, right?
When it does turn off, do all the lights go off?
No, the power light, the actual button where you turn on, that I know for sure stays on. But it says monitor going to sleep. So I'm thinking there's no connection I don't know. I'm a novice.
It's very possible that you had some sort of... Is it very hot where the computer is?
It's in the corner of the house, but the house is pretty much temperature controlled.
Okay, then. It is very possible that you've done some damage to the computer. I can't tell what. Could be the motherboard, could be the power supply, although that's less likely if there's still lights on the thing itself. You need to get that to somebody to take a look at what might have happened.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Could it be possible, like permanent damage to the thing? Or
it's certainly possible. There's a whole range of things that could be wrong. The best thing to do is take it to a reputable dealer, have them check it out, and they'll tell you exactly where the problem lies and how to fix it. And and when you're done with all that, your better bet is to get an uninterruptible power supply.
Yeah, exactly.
Surge protectors are almost a false security. Surges are...
Now, almost about it.
And they're very cheap, correct?
They're very cheap, too,
and surges, the work they're going to do.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Surges are a very, very rare occurrence. It's the brownouts and the dips and the overvolts that are much more common. You know, the refrigerator turns on and your lights dim. And that's something a UPS can handle, an uninterruptible power supply.
Uninterruptible.
And I can never pronounce that.
It's an old computer. Is it possible that this put it over the edge?
Yeah, very possible. Very possible.
Okay.
One of the things you want to look out for is there's two types of uninterruptible power supplies. One has a battery that waits until there's a problem and then jumps in.
Okay.
And there's another one, and I can't remember. They have names.
Voltage regulators or...
Yeah, I forget.
Something like that.
But the other one line conditioning or something. The one you want, I believe, is the line conditioning one. And that one, the battery actually runs the computer all the time, and the power recharges the battery all the time. Because a battery can take a surge like nobody's business, and you won't notice it. Also,
I'm in the market for another computer. What I'm concerned about now is my wife's pictures and stuff that she wants off that computer.
Right,
it's like.
Do I have to get the computer fixed in order to take that data off of there?
No, luckily.
Unfortunately, she never backed up her computer. This is her computer.
Yeah, well, then she could be out of luck, and that's too bad. I'm sorry to say. Don't have an answer for that. But if you're very lucky, the drives are still good, and when you buy that new computer, assuming you're buying a tower instead of a desktop.
Correct. Yeah, I have everything else other than just the tower.
All right. So if you're buying the tower, if you buy locally, right, you can bring them your old computer and ask them to add the other drive to it.
Correct. Oh, perfect. Yeah, because I usually go to the
the local computer stores. So.
Perfect. And then if you do that, the first thing you're going to do is what?
Back up.
Yes, well done. Well done.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, guys, I appreciate your help, and I love the show. I'm sorry that you left LAM, but you guys are great on this station.
Thank you. We're very happy to be here.
No problem. Thank you very much, guys.
Have fun.
You too.
All right. Yeah, we've. That reminds me. I meant to say this right at the top of the show. If you're too warm, your computer is even warmer. You need to remember that computers need to be babied. If you want to risk yourself, that's your business. But take care of your computer. Make sure it stays cool. If you don't have air conditioning, turn it off during the day. Make sure it's not near a window. There's no sunlight shining on it. You know, all of that stuff. There's really kind of no way you're going to keep it cool otherwise. You can take the cover off if you've got a desktop. You can take the case off it and blow a fan right on the components. Now, in the long run, that'll make it filthy. But in the short run for now, you know, while we're in this little heat wave, it probably is not a bad idea to help keep the components. Nothing ages a computer's components faster than heat. So it would be a good idea, particularly, by the way, if you have any one of the many, many, many Mac products that don't have a fan in them.
No, they all have fans, just really small, quiet ones.
Well, yeah, as in non-usable for this kind of heat. So you want to be very careful. The same is true of laptops. I shouldn't talk. This one, if there's a fan in here, I don't know it.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing with this. Any of these netbooks or whatever, yep. There's probably a fan in there that's no bigger than the fan in there.
Yeah, it's like it's a one-inch little fan right in the middle of the...
Yeah, I suspect this is probably not even a one-inch fan. And so the reality is it might as well not be a fan. And also if it's blowing out the bottom... and you've got a case around it like Steve does, or you, in particular, you know, my daughter spends all day with it next to her on the couch, which means it's covering up any available air holes. So you want to be very, very careful with that.
You don't really want to use a laptop on your lap. In fact, we're trying to make a concerted effort to call them notebooks now.
Yeah, right.
One, they're too hot for your lap, and you don't know what sterilization procedures might occur.
Yeah.
But they're too hot for your lap, and you can get hurt. We sell at our store a couple of different active cooling laptop stands that have fans in them. We have this really cool gel material that absorbs the heat and softens, and then when it cools off, it releases its heat back to the air and then hardens up again.
Cool.
Aerospace gel, it calls itself, or something like that.
Very nice. It actually talks?
Yeah.
Wow. That's got to be even cooler than the fact that it absorbs heat.
But not many people can hear it.
Yeah, I'm sure you're the only one, Steve. I'm sure you're the only one. I actually had a problem yesterday with my transformer, the Asus EEE Pad Transformer TF101, it's called. It's a 10-inch Android tablet.
Why do PC companies have to come up with such crazy names?
Well, everything from Asus these days seems to be an EEE device of some sort, and this is the EEE pad, and the reason it's called the Transformer is because you can hook it into a keyboard and turn it into a laptop.
Yeah, that's neat.
Which is really neat. I'm waiting for the keyboard to come in. The cool thing about the keyboard is it actually includes another battery. So I get about 9 hours off the battery that's in the thing. Plus, then I can plug it into this thing, and it'll recharge that battery, get another 9 hours, or run off that battery, get another 9 hours. So it's really very, very cool. But and it is the only Android keyboard I've seen that actually has a mouse pad. There's a special driver in this version of Android they've added that it'll actually run a mouse.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm waiting to see that. I'm waiting for that to come in. These were back-ordered forever and then suddenly appeared, and the cases are still back-ordered. But this was the point here is this was in my trunk the other day, yesterday, actually. I took all my crew and my daughter, because I wanted to sleep with both eyes closed, to see Captain America yesterday. So it was sitting in the trunk, warm for a couple of hours, maybe like 3 or 4, and when I got home, it was not working, absolutely not working. So I set it aside, let it in the computer room, which has air conditioning, let it cool off, And about an hour later, I tried it. It was fine. But it had clearly shut down because of the heat. Heat is...
Typically, computers have thermistors in them that they will shut themselves down before being damaged by overheating. But if you run it too close to that limit for too long, you can really reduce the lifespan.
Well, that's just it. As I said, heat ages components. Always has. The problem is one of the byproducts of shoving electricity through tiny little wires is heat. And so there's always heat in the machine. But when that heat has nowhere to dissipate because the air is as hot as the computer, you really start to age those components. So be very, very careful. Listen, we're going to take a little break. We will be back with Steve Ray, Linda Wildman, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Start again.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
She pointed to us to start, but she forgot to hit the button.
We're clearly not entirely prepared for today, and that's, I'm sure, my fault because I don't know what the heck I'm doing today. It's the heat. Just like computers, humans can overheat. We're like the rock trolls, like the trolls in on Discworld. The hotter they get, the stupider they get. The colder they get, the smarter they get.
Interesting.
All right, we're back. Oh, we have John. We have John from Henrietta on the line. You snuck that in on me, you little minx. All right. Welcome, John. What's your question?
My question today regards a caller you spoke with earlier. The first thing he's supposed to do is back up his new computer. And I recently got a Lenovo laptop and tried to do the backup with the Microsoft 7 software.
Oh, yeah.
About 50% of the way through, it goes haywire and says backup did not complete. And it's a 0x800704 5D IO error.
Yeah.
Oh, no, IO error?
Oh.
What's
that number again?
I think it's 0x800704 5D.
An IO error is an input output error. So there's a problem either reading your computer's hard drive or writing to your backup drive. Either way, it's not good. It could mean there's something wrong with one of those drives or the other drive.
Are you trying to back up to DVD?
No, I'm backing up to an external hard drive.
Is that external hard drive formatted FAT32 or NTFS?
It's NTFS.
Okay. That should be okay on a Windows 7 machine.
You know what? I'm wondering if it's...
This has been... I've done some searching on the Internet and found that it's a problem that's existed for some time with Vista.
Yep.
We have said for a while that the Windows backup software isn't that good. Is that a polite way of saying it? it's better than it used to be, but it's still not quite that good.
Yeah, I believe the problem actually is that it's a syncing issue. The speed of the drive that you're connecting to is fine, but that USB connection isn't fast enough, and it gets out of sync. It sends data and then has to get an acknowledgement that it got those data, and then it sends and it gets and it sends and it gets, and somehow that got a little confused. And so you get an error. What that error essentially means is I don't know what's going on and I got to shut down.
Is it by any chance a USB 1 drive or is it USB 2?
It's USB 2.
Yeah.
Should be enough.
It should be enough.
The external can handle USB 3, but it's...
Right. You don't have that
USB
in the machine.
USB 2
right.
On a computer. Yeah.
I believe that's where the problem lies. Your best bet at this point, I believe, is to use a completely different... backup program. There are lots of them available if it's just your data.
We've talked about a few of them in the past. Cobain backup.
Right.
Where's my list here? 3-2-1 backup rule. Bacula.
Bacula's very good.
We've talked about. Yeah.
You can also, of course, just simply drag and drop.
Drag and drop your files. Yeah. The nice thing about an automatic backup program is it will keep track of what files you've changed and then only back up those changed files, so you don't have to remember which ones have changed, which is kind of handy.
Right. So if you keep that hard drive connected all the time, and you're running Cobain or Bacula in the background, whenever you change a file, Bacula or Cobain, you'll run those in the background on a schedule, of course. When they see that there are changed files available, they'll just automatically back them up.
Some external hard drives come with their own backup software as well, since that's such a common thing to do with an external hard drive.
Right. This one did not.
Yeah, but either of those, and they're both listed on our website. If you go to our website,
Cobain or Bacula.
Yep.
Right. If you go to our website at soundbites.org, you will see the across the top, there's a series of tabs. The third tab is links. And if you click on that, the there's a list of things in site. And
search for
number
backup.
Six is a list of sites mentioned weekly on the show. And then you can control F and search for backup. And you'll see the ones that we've got available there. Check them all out. And pick the one that you think is best.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much.
Our pleasure. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Sure. And that, of course, is our cue to remind all of you to do your backups. This is the perfect weekend to do it, because heaven knows you're not doing anything else this weekend. It's way too hot.
Do I have a sound effect for that?
For heaven knows, or for
no, the backup.
Oh, backup, yes. Any sound you got an engine? Have you got the beep,
the beep, beep, beep,
beep, beep,
yeah.
Beep, if you've got that, that's what we'll take. That's we really should have that sound, and we really should run it at least once a week to remind people it's time to back up. We'll have to work on that, absolutely. But that's that. It is time. It is past time. You know that. I've been having a discussion on Google Plus with a bunch of people about backing up, and this one guy, it started out with a discussion about Lion, and he said he downloaded Lion, burned it to a DVD, and made a copy onto each of his four hard drives.
Yep.
And he went through three out of four of them, because the first two times it died in the middle of the update.
Wow.
He doesn't know why yet, yeah. Obviously.
Probably incompatible software.
Whatever, but yep. The third one worked. The problem is apparently the installer destroys itself as it's doing the install. So if you have not made a copy, oh well. Now, I guess you can still download. Well, it did
yeah,
for him.
You can always download it again.
You can always download it again at 4.5 gigabytes. But he had copies everywhere, so he was okay with that. And that reminded all of us to talk about backups. And he said, I've got it backed up on DVD, and I've got it backed up on all four of my hard drives. So, of course, I wrote back and said, what, no offsite storage? And he says, well, it's 4.5 gigabytes. I didn't really want to use my bandwidth. I said, no, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. The first time I was very careful when I did my initial backup to the cloud. I did a little bit, and then the next day I added a few more, and the next day I added a few more until I had them all up there. And now I can go back and forth with just rsync, and that'll do it. There was a note of a guy who got shut down by Comcast.
Yep.
Because he put all his data up on the web, all his music up on the web. It was like gigabytes worth of music. And then the next month, he did it again, apparently, or added more, or whatever. And the third month, Comcast shut him down for a year, said no more for you for a year.
Yeah, a lot of the ISPs are starting to put data caps on their networks. Comcast, I think, has a 250-gigabyte cap. Time Warner and some other cities have a 100-gigabyte cap. Fortunately, here in Rochester, we don't have one yet. But you got to worry about that when you're thinking about your online backup. And then online music is an additional complication, because the record industry is asking internet providers to be copyright police.
Yep.
And so they can shut you down thinking you are violating copyright. They don't have to prove anything. They don't have to go to court. They send a letter to your provider, and the provider shuts you down. Some of the providers are nicer about it and saying you got to take them to court first, but some of them just say, okay, shut them down.
And now, that leads me to a separate thing. I'm in the Spotify beta.
Right.
And no, I don't have any invites. They don't allow us invites.
There's also Rhapsody streaming music and Ardio streaming music. It's a streaming music
and
service.
And Pandora, a bunch of others. So I can put all my music up there and play it and share it and download other, not download, but listen to other people's music and yada, yada, yada. And somehow the folks at Spotify have made that okay. It's all legal, right? The problem is if I'm going to do that, for example, to my mobile device, I pay $10 a month. But now I can stream every piece of music ever written, including my entire library. But I'm going to hit my data cap in about, a day.
Yep.
And if I'm on someplace that caps you even through the wire, what is the point of that? How is that any good? On top of that, there's all the other stuff that everybody wants you to put online.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to use Google Docs and I'm going to be on Google Plus where every other post is an animated GIF, I'm going to start using, there's one right there.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using my bandwidth like mad, and eventually all of these online things, all these online services are going to be unusable to me.
Yep.
So there's the war. And at what point does somebody like Google step in and say, screw it, we're starting our own ISP?
Google and Amazon both have their cloud music services. And they have taken the tack that we're already paying a license, at least in Amazon's case, they're already paying a license to sell streaming music and to sell downloading music. So it's okay for our users to upload their music. What's interesting is you physically have to upload all of your discs.
Well, and that's my point. It has nothing to do.
Right.
I'm not talking about the service itself. I can't use the service because my ISP tells me, you haven't got enough bandwidth, and I'm not going to give it to you at the price point you're paying.
Yeah. One of the things that Apple is trying to do on their iCloud music service is that they're getting licenses ahead of time. With Amazon, they're saying, we're already covered, and we're waiting for the IRA to sue them. But with Apple's music service, it reads your iTunes list, and if you own a song that is already in the iTunes store, you don't have to upload it again. They know you bought it, and you can stream it. And that's what MP3.com tried to do 10 years ago when the RIAA sued them out of existence.
Right. But even so,
you still got the download bandwidth.
You've got the download bandwidth. I have the same problem with Pandora. I can listen to anything I want to listen to, but I'm going to run out of my cap very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get a whole month's use out of my phone.
Make good use of the data statistics app on your phone.
Well, exactly. And the problem is that still shows up the dichotomy, which I think in very short order is going to become a war between the people who want you to store things online, and that's not just Google and Amazon, but now it's Apple and Spotify and everybody else on Earth, and the data providers, the last mile providers, who are telling you we can't afford to let you use any of that stuff at the price point that you're willing to pay.
And then there's the conflict between a lot of the ISPs that are also content providers, like Time Warner, Roadrunner has all the Warner Brothers movie houses. Comcast, owned by NBC Universal, other movie houses, they don't want you to stream music and TV shows over the internet. They want you to buy it from them. So there's a lot of arguments about, Comcast is shutting down people streaming music. Why are they doing it? Because they want you to buy the music from Universal Records, or because it's eating up the bandwidth? And they're saying it's data shaping to cut down on the data hogs, but it's terrible. What's happening in the industry? And we're hoping that somehow the FCC net neutrality laws might help clean it up. But the way the regulation is written now, it's kind of vague. The ISPs have to treat data as neutral, but they are allowed to shape their networks.
Right.
So if someone is hogging all the bandwidth, they can shut them down.
Right.
But they can't shut them down because they're stealing a movie.
Right. Right. It's very weird, and I think we're just beginning to see the fallout of this. We'll see what comes of it. You know that Google actually put together a their own network in a town, I think in Kansas, I want to say it was.
Topeka changed their name to Google Kansas.
Oh, but didn't
they
get
lost
it.
The bid. Right, it went to Kansas City, Missouri.
Right. And it was a Kansas
City. No, they went to Kansas City, Kansas.
Kansas City, Kansas. And they have, and I'm very angry at my friends at Google who did not make it Rochester, New York. I just want to put that out there one more time. You know I'm talking to you. But there's a real war brewing, I think. Did Google do this just because they could, just to test the waters? Is it the first step? I don't know any of that. You know, I really don't know any of that. But it would seem to me that at some point, Google, Apple, all of those people are going to look at what's happening out there and say, people aren't, particularly somebody like Google, who makes money off the ad revenue of all of that stuff, right? And they're going to look at it and say, we're losing money because of these internet service providers, and we need to fix this.
Yeah, we want you to use the web more because we get paid every time you do.
That's exactly right. I'm on Google Plus, and you know, everybody puts up animated GIFs, and the reality is that's a lot of bandwidth. That's a lot of bandwidth, and everybody puts up videos for you to see. Well, you know what? If they're on YouTube, Google makes a nickel every time I see one of those ads that annoyingly pops up inside the video. But if I can't afford the bandwidth to go see those, then you know what? I'm going to start running all those Google, those YouTube blockers and all that other stuff. And Google's, maybe not from me alone, but from the hundreds of millions of other people, are going to notice there's a hit going there. And they're going to have to step back and take stock. And how do they fix their revenue problem? Because that's really what it comes down to. How does Google fix their revenue problem when the last milers, the internet service providers that provide you directly with your internet service, tell you that you've got to slow down? All right, that's it. Is that a 60 or a 30 there, Linda? Okay, we're going to take a little break now. You've wasted an entire hour of your life listening to sound bites, but luckily for you, there's a whole nother hour coming up. So put your feet up. Get a cold towel for your forehead. Actually, a cold towel on the back of your neck is really helpful. And we'll be back on the other side of these lovely announcements with a whole lot more of this show. We have Steve Ray. We have Linda Wildman, who is doing a magnificent job standing in for Dave Enright, who's one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest. I'm Nick Francesco. We'll be back sooner than it will take you to go to the icebox and grab a cake of ice to sit on. Nobody has an icebox anymore. How old am I? And back with more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
America's longest-running computer show, Sound Bites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
Forgot who you were for a minute there, but she got there. And we're back. It's the second hour of Sound Bites, and we're going to start it off in slam-bang fashion with Fritz from Canandaigua. Welcome, Fritz. What's your question?
Welcome, everybody. You were talking about data usage. This past week, I read a blog post by Jerry Pornell, who was... He wrote for Byte magazine.
Yeah, he's
for
back
years,
writing for the new Byte,
coming back into existence. And he needed an internet connection. He had moved, and he needed to get some writing done, and he needed some temporary. So he got a MiFi, and he had set it all up. And he was, you know, smart. He's smart enough to check his data usage, and he looked back maybe a couple of hours later, and he saw something like 160 megabytes of data usage, and he had not been using his computer at all for anything major. And he tracked it down, and he found out that he had left Firefox open, and the tabs refresh constantly.
Yep.
And they use data on them.
So all the advertisements that are on a website can refresh. The website themselves can refresh, especially if you're on a news site. You know, every few seconds, it will push a new news story to you.
And he's thinking, gee, yep. I haven't done anything. How come I'm, you know, using all this data? And he finally tracked it down to that.
Yep.
So I thought I'd pass that on. Anybody using MiFi or, I don't know.
Well, even on your phones.
Yeah, you know, and the same.
Pad device, yeah. The same thing, yeah. Unless you have the device set to go to sleep.
I understand.
Yep. But
okay.
Then sometimes those background, you know, data packets can wake the device back up again without you knowing it.
Yep.
Okay, sir.
It's a real problem, and we're going to find that as more and more people use these devices, for example, I know that both iDevices and Android devices can update in the background, sometimes they don't shut down a thing.
People have been crying for wireless sync on their iPod for years because they don't want to have to plug it into the USB. Well, now it's going to start updating over your 3G and eating your data up. So you're going to have to be really careful about when you enable that sync to make sure it's only when you're on Wi-Fi and not when you're on 3G.
Well, I thought I'd pass that on, gentlemen.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
You too. It's pretty interesting. We're seeing a lot of that going on. All right. Bucking standards, conventions, and software versioning, Linus Torvalds has designated the new release of the Linux operating system kernel, posted yesterday, as version 3.0, even while maintaining that the release is only a routine update. Sure, we have the usual two-thirds driver changes and lots of random fixes, but the point is the 3.0 is just about renumbering. No breakage, no special scary new features, nothing at all like that, Torvalds wrote on the Linux kernel mailing list. The new kernel was almost released on July 19th, but the last-minute discovery of a subtle bug and testing of a patch for it delayed the release. For the past 8 years, the volunteer developers behind Linux have been laboring on version 2.6. This new release was bumped up to version 3.0 in honor of Linux's 20th anniversary, which takes place this year, actually next month, as well as to streamline the increasingly cumbersome version numbering. The previous stable version of the Linux kernel was 2.6.39.3, which is far too close to the type of numbering Apple does. This new release features improvements in virtualization and file system support, in addition to the usual round of bug fixes and performance tuning. For those of you who care about these things, 4 years in the making, this version of the kernel is the first able to grant Xen hypervisor DOM 0, domain 0 privileges. By having DOM 0 privileges, the Xen hypervisor can run as a primary or most privileged layer for the computer. It can then parcel out access to other guest operating systems, which should speed performance of these guests. Previous versions of Xen offered this capability only by applying patches to the kernel. One of the interesting things is they've been able to save 50 milliseconds per context switch, which is a huge, huge savings. Much work has also been done on improving support for the BTRFS, or the BTree file system, which is a new storage system-friendly file system. Improvements were also made to the kernel work, the way the kernel works with the ext4 file system, which is currently the default file system in a lot of Linux distributions. Several significant changes have been made on the networking front. The kernel features a new just-in-time compiler for network packets, one that allows applications to only receive those network packets relevant to their operation. Oh, this is the 50 nanoseconds. I apologize. This can save up to 50 nanoseconds per packet, which is a gigantic savings. For wireless users, the kernel now includes wake on wireless LAN capabilities for wireless networks. Are you excited about the 3.0 kernel? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415, just like Don did from Hilton, New York. Welcome, Don. What's your question? Beg your pardon. Oh, there you are. Sorry, start again, please.
Okay. You're discussing wireless usage, and I ran into something. I have an Android, and I was over at Niagara on the Lake, and I was not using any data. I just had it turned on, and I got a message that I had used up $2 worth of data for roaming. Now, I have unlimited data for myself, but doing nothing, it used up $2 worth of roaming.
Right. That's not the wireless, though. That's the 3G.
Yeah.
I found the only way to prevent that is to put it in airplane mode and turn off the whole damn phone.
Right.
Airplane mode will turn off all of the radios, so all the Wi-Fi, all the 3Gs. There usually is an option to turn off just 3G to leave the Wi-Fi on. One of the problems is that wireless means several different things. Wi-Fi is a specific type of wireless networking between computers, and then 3G is a specific type of wireless networking between cell phones. So it's important to understand that Wi-Fi is generally free and 3G is generally paid for, even though they're both wireless. And most cell phone, smartphone, tablet devices will have a way to turn off 3G but leave on Wi-Fi. And the problem is especially when you go out by on a lake or out in more remote areas, you may be so far away from a cell phone tower that it ramps up the power on your phone trying to reach that signal, and it can add to your 3G data by trying to connect to that signal. If you did have, say, a web page open in the background and you closed the web page, if you didn't close it completely, if you just switched away from the website, as the last caller was mentioning, that website can update itself over 3G in the background and add to your 3G roaming. Especially if you're away from your home, you can end up with a roaming wheel. I remember once I was in Brockport and got picked up by a Canadian cell phone tower. And I tried to dial a phone number in Rochester, and a Canadian operator came on and asked me who I was trying to dial. What am I doing in Canada? You know, and you hear about that in San Diego. People will get Mexican cell phone towers accidentally. So it's important to look at the status symbols on your phone. There's typically different symbols for Wi-Fi versus 3G, and to take a look at your settings and turn off 3G when you know you're not going to be using the data so that it doesn't update itself. In fact, there was an issue which Windows Phone 7. There were a lot of early complaints that it was running up dozens of megabytes a day doing nothing. And Microsoft said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the phone in the background updating itself, checking for things, checking for updates to things. And it can add up data, and if you're away from your home network, it can add up to roaming. And you may have unlimited data on your cell phone plan, but you got to check to see if that's unlimited roaming as well. It may only be unlimited in your home network. And here we have a lot of people that go to the Finger Lakes area here, and if you end up down at the south end of one of the lakes, you may not be in your home area anymore.
Yeah, well, that's basically what happened is, I didn't realize I was doing anything. Thank goodness Verizon sent me a note.
Yep.
Yep.
And told me I'd run up $2 worth. So the only answer I knew at the time is shut off the phone.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I hadn't used the phone at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And so I just thought, as a warning to people, if you're going across Canada, be able, or out of your area, be able to shut off that
yep.
data network because it's updating itself.
Yep. Good tip. Thank you so much.
We hear stories every now and then about people multi-$1,000 cell phone bills for using data that they didn't know they were using, or someone downloaded a movie and they didn't know they were on 3G.
Getting multi-thousand.
Yep.
Yep.
So it can be tricky. So get to know your mobile device. Get to know where those settings are to turn off 3G. Most mobile devices, cell phones, will have an airplane mode, they call it, which turns off all of the radios so that you can safely use it in an airplane. Although I always say if my cell phone can mess up the airplane, fix the airplane.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then take a look. Your phone also should have a data usage screen to keep track of how much data you're actually using. But we've also heard from people where the app on the phone isn't as accurate as your cell phone company's website. So if you log into your account management on the web, you get a more accurate data usage.
Right.
But that uses data to check your data?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So do it on a different computer?
Yep. All right, our next caller is Linda from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda. What's your question?
Okay, I got a comment. Thank you very much for last week's helping me out. I restarted the whole thing, and I got everything back where it was supposed to be.
Excellent. Great. That's what we like to hear.
I do have a question, though. I've been trying to get on my smartphone, trying to get local, like 13, 10, or 8. They've all got new apps, but now I can't seem to download them on my phone. I'm just wondering, it's the Android 2.2, but it seems to be, you know, I told you they had Boost Mobile, part of the Sprint network, but it seems to be that I can't do that. Is there any reason why I can't do that?
What happens when you try to download the apps?
Okay, I download a 13. It says, we have a new app. Hit it here. But for some reason, I can't download the new app.
And what is the error message that you get?
It's not an error message. It's 13's new. It's 13's website, and it says, we have a new app. Click the bar above. And every time I do that, nothing happens.
All right. It may be as simple as the fact that you've... they should tell you this on the webpage. You may need to turn on download from untrusted sources.
And it may also be an iPhone app and not an Android app.
No, because I listened to the news on 13. It says you can now get it on iPhone, Android, and such on iPad. So, it comes from DOPP.com, and I don't know if that's a trusted app or not.
No, it's not a trusted app. So what you need to do is you need to go into Settings.
Okay.
And then Applications.
Okay.
And it depends on which version you see. It probably says Unknown Sources, Allow Installation of Non-Market Applications, and you have to check that on.
Okay.
But be very careful that you're in the right that you're getting the right product. Now, obviously, if you're clicking on a link right on the Channel 13 website, that should be fine.
Yeah.
But you want to be very careful of that. And after you've downloaded those apps, turn that off again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at their website right now, and the only thing you can download is a Verizon VCast application.
Huh.
There's a website you can go to. Premium services available from other networks, but it looks. Let me see. I'm still scrolling here. It's looking for. There's a mobile.13om.com website. There we go. If you look down far enough, there's an iPhone app, a BlackBerry app, wireless a web access site. I don't see an Android app on their website.
Because they said there was one on the news program. But I've got it on my iTouch, but I was just wondering, so I was just curious.
If they say they have one, they don't have it listed on their mobile site yet.
Oh, yeah. But I tell you, Nick, I did take your advice. I got not Lookout,
yeah.
Security. Do you know I liked it so much, I paid $29.99 for their version.
That's what I like to hear.
And it's doing everything. Every app I download, it says this one is safe.
Yep, but I love to hear that you not only is it working for you, but you love it and you paid for it. I always suggest people do that because God knows we need them to keep making this stuff.
Oh yeah, okay.
You may have better luck going to the Android market. Yeah, here I found that. In the Android market.
They know nothing about. That's the one they pull up. The DOPP. It's by DOPP.com, but that's the old version, and I can't update it. So I don't know. And I tried 8 and 10, Channel 8 and Channel 10, and they don't have one either. So I guess I'll have to stick with my iTouch.
All right, hold on a second.
I don't see.
I'm on there now. I have to sign. It's not going to work here.
Yeah, I went to the Android market and found the 13WAM TV Android app. It doesn't say it from DOPP.
Yeah, well, see, I went into... I went into AT&T, which is the store right next to Best Buy Mobile, and they can get it on their Android phones, but I guess
It may be the version of Android you have on your phone.
It's 2.2. I could get mostly everything, but the only thing I can't get is 13 news.
That's weird.
I get the old version, but not the new one.
Maybe the new version requires Android 3. That could be.
I don't know. It says, click here for the new app, but I can't.
All right, Linda, I'm sorry. We got to go take a break.
Okay.
But you might want to talk to the folks at the store. If they can download it, they may be able to figure out why you can't.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, we're going to take a break, back in just a couple of minutes with Sound Bites right here on Member Supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
And at 22 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. Hey, before we go anywhere else, our friend Bon Vibra has an idea that I think is excellent. He's asking us if we want to have a Second Life event for our anniversary in Second Life, leading up to the show, the day after the show, we could host it either before the show in the morning, but that's a little tough for us. The real problem, of course, being that we still have to drive here to get here.
Yeah.
And we can't take over the studio early.
Oh, sure we could.
But we could. Just kick Stephen, Alan Ray out. But we could have a Second Life event perhaps after the show. If this is something you're interested in, go to the Soundbites website, get into the forums. If you're not registered, it's easy enough to do. And check with the Second Life part of the forum, and you have to scroll down to find it. And look for the post called Soundbite Show Advertisement, and check it out. Leave your information there, and we'll see what happens. We could have all kinds of cool stuff going on there. I love the idea. I just wonder what the rest of you all think. I think it's a great idea. The iPad is breaking records with 9.25 million sales in the last 3 months and also looks to be making big gains in the traditional PC market, a report claims. According to number crunching carried out by Business Insider, the iPad now represents 11% of the PC market, up from 7% in January of this year. Business Insider's calculations are based on figures released this week by Apple and figures released earlier this month by analyst firm IDC about the state of the global PC market. IDC's figures put PC sales, not including tablets, at 84.4 million for the last quarter. Based on this assumption, the assumption that most iPads are sold to consumers, and that overall, and I don't know that that's a good assumption, and that overall PC sales are roughly split half and half between business and consumers. I'm not sure that's good either. Business Insider said the iPad has already sucked up about 20% of the consumer PC market. The iPad alone would make Apple the fourth largest computer brand in the world after HP, Dell, and Lenovo, and ahead of Acer. When Mac sales are considered, Apple becomes the second largest computer brand in the world. The report concludes that Microsoft's domination of the PC market is no longer secure. Looking into the future, the iPad could pose even more of a danger to Microsoft's PC market share. iOS 5, to be released in the autumn of this year, will allow you to set up an iPad without using a computer. While until now, iPads have been a secondary device requiring the owner to also have a Mac or Windows-based PC, iOS 5 will give customers the potential to own just an iPad. So our question to you, are you ready to give up your PC for a tablet? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. Now, I got to say, interestingly, I was talking to somebody at work, and I said, I've got, I think I'm making a lot of groups happy this week. I've got an article about Android. I've got an article about iPad. I've got an article about Linux. He said, you've hit all the major operating systems. I said, well, there's this one we've missed from a little company called Microsoft. And he had to stop and think for a minute and said, you're right. Has Microsoft, do you think, slipped out of the American conscious?
And most of the news you hear from them is bad about breaches and security holes.
Right, right. But it appears that all the momentum is on the side of Apple and Google and Linux, and Microsoft is just kind of floating along. On the other hand, what I'm also hearing is that while there are an incredible number of iPad sales, the thing they're mostly cannibalizing at this point are the iPod sales. You know, and that rather than adding iPad sales to the phenomenal success of the iPod world, a lot of people are replacing their pod devices with pad devices.
Yeah. Bigger screen, faster processor, and just more useful. Although I still have an iPod because it's small enough to fit in my pocket.
Well, and that's just it. You know, is that I don't know that that's really true because if I'm gonna, I'm an Android guy, so I put it all on my phone. But if I were to want my music, I'd want a small enough device to carry around that's not my tablet where I got to throw it in a backpack and have an extra long cable for my headphones or whatever I'm gonna do with it. So that's a good question. All right, our next caller is Gil from Webster, New York. Welcome, Gil. What's your question?
Well, actually, I had a comment, and you know, on this nice warm day, I think it was very apropos that you bring up the heat stroke suffering that our machines may be going through, and they're silent sufferers. And so, anyway, I thought I'd call in and contribute a little actual data to the state of here. So I'm sitting in my computer now, and we're sitting with the air conditioning on, and in spite of that, things are down to about 79, you know, where it's cool.
Yeah.
And the air conditioning is fighting away, and it's losing, I guess.
Yeah.
So now I'm sitting in the computer area, and if I look around with my little temperature sensor, it's about 82 in here.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at my screen, for example, one of the screens, my ViewSonic screen, is 89. If I look at my Samsung screen, it's 88, let's say. If I look at the outside of my two machines, one is 82, the other is 83. Interestingly, under the table, it's about 84 or 85.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's sort of in the 80s around here. And I mean, I have to say I'm a little bit roasty toasty, but hey, I'll suffer for the soundbite show.
Thanks.
But now here's the telling thing. So inside my computer, I have an Asus board in one machine, which has some instrumentation to measure the temperature. And the motherboard itself is running at about 96, which is a good 10 degrees 12 degrees, 14 degrees higher than, you know, the computers themselves on the outside. The North Bridge, which is a chip that sort of sits off the CPU, is running at 109 degrees. This is all Fahrenheit, obviously.
Yep.
And, you know, so that's getting kind of roasty-toasty, but there are fans in there and so forth. The South Bridge is working even harder and is up to 114 degrees. And I would say, relatively speaking, this is probably a cool day for my computer. Sometimes it runs up to, say, 120 degrees on those chips inside the computer, and that's probably a safe temperature. I usually try to keep them below 125 degrees, but you know, when the temperature starts to get elevated, I mean, it can be a good 10, 20, 30 degrees warmer down where it really counts.
Yeah. Is this a desktop or a laptop?
Well, I was giving you two towers.
Okay.
And
I was looking at my laptop. My CPU is running at 153 degrees. Yep. My North Bridge chip is 130. The enclosure is 92 degrees.
Yep.
Which is why you can't set it on your lap anymore.
That's it. So my tower is 82 degrees, which is actually one of the cooler spots around here. But I still wouldn't want to set it on my lap if I.
Yeah, which is funny because in the winter, the tower under your desk keeps your feet warm.
Yes.
You're right.
It's indeed true. So, but back in the old days, now I'm speaking in ancient times, back in the 70s and 80s.
Wow, you're old.
Yeah, well, you know, we're about the same age, I think.
Yes, I think we are.
So as it goes back in those days, when it got to be 85 in the computer room, outside, that is, you know, air temperature
right.
in the room itself, the computer would start to show interesting signs of computational, let's call it, very
misadventure.
interesting developments on its own. It would get creative. We would do creative computing, and answers would start to diverge, and then eventually we got a little bit closer to 90 degrees, and things would start to take catastrophic failures. But actually, above 80, it was you know, kind of a critical thing, and that was because the temperatures weren't as well handled back in those days. But, you know, the same thing happens nowadays, but, you know, clearly they've gotten the temperatures up higher and things work better. But just be aware that, you know, you could get some creative computing right on your lap, Steve, without much trouble.
Yep,
absolutely. Thanks,
okay.
Gil.
Well, keep up the good work, guys.
We will. Thank you.
Take care.
We have people bring their computers into the shop and say it's running hot.
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it will.
So take a look at, you know, it's nice to look at your temperatures over time to see what normal is. You know, 150 degrees is normal for my laptop.
Right. And it really is, I don't know that we can stress this enough in this heat. It's, according to my computer, it's 90. Probably the real temperature's actually a little higher. I mean,
in the room here?
The real outside.
Oh, the outside.
The temperature out there is probably a little higher, actually.
90 degrees.
Yeah, 90. Okay, I'm actually accurate now.
82. Well, it hasn't been refreshed.
Oh, okay. But it's around 90, and that's around too hot for your computer, probably. So if you are, in fact, in an area that does not have air conditioning, you're probably looking at trouble. If you are in an area that has air conditioning, you want to keep it high because it's cheaper, and you want to keep it low because your computer will be healthier. So find whatever medium you believe you can do. And for those of you who, you know, our Soundbites listeners are geeks to begin with, so you've probably got five or six computers running out over there, and your phone and your pads and your devices and your things, and turn some of them off for Pete's sake, you know. I'm not telling you to go out in the woods with a hatchet and a banjo, but maybe you could just turn off some of your machines and only leave one or two on, and make yourself a little cooler. And pay attention also to things like your television and your game consoles, because those run awfully hot. Even if you've got, you know, everybody says, "Oh, I got an LCD that doesn't run hot." Really, put your hand over the top of it. They can significantly raise the temperature in a room, significantly.
The older models use fluorescent lights, which generate quite a bit of heat. The newer models are using LEDs, but they're still too expensive to be in the general use yet.
Right.
If you pay a little more for your monitor, you get LED backlighting, but people don't like to pay a little more.
Yeah, that is very true. So you want to be a little careful of that. We can't stress that enough. We don't want you losing your computer. So be a little more careful, be a little more considerate of our inanimate friends.
I went to a large data center in town a week or so ago for a service call, and the air conditioner was bigger than the building it was cooling.
Oh, at RIT, just in the data center that I'm in, there are multiple air conditioners all working together, because it's just rack after rack after rack after rack of computers, and we need to keep them cool. Back in the day, we had our own data center.
That was always the best place to spend the time, because it was nice and cool in there.
Now, back when we had our own data center, they made a horrible mistake when they put it in. They plumbed it for the wrong air conditioner. They plumbed it for one that was much, much too big for the room. And it actually was cheaper for them to just give us that air conditioner than replumb everything.
Wow.
So you could keep sides of meat in that room if you wanted to. So in the summer, and it was big enough that, you know, my entire crew, we found things to do in that server room in the summer, and we bring sweaters. You know, we all kept coats hanging, sweaters hanging in that room. And we'd find excuses in the summer, particularly, you know, when they have energy abatement, where they turn off the air or whatever they do. They couldn't do that in the computer room, of course. So we'd all go in the computer room to work, and it would be more than cool enough for a half a dozen people in all those machines. And it still didn't heat up enough to take your sweater off. So,
but it's a little loud, though, so there's a trade-off.
There is a little loud, and so we all had our little earplugs. One of our guys who's a shooter, brought in a bunch of earplugs with us. I also discovered that at that time in my life when I was taking my daughter to those little weekend grammar school dances, those little earplugs were great. They were great. I had about a half a dozen packages, unopened packages in my pocket, and I was sitting there with a bunch of the parents, and they're all going, "You're not bothered by this at all." And I turned my head and I pointed to the little orange thing in my ear and I said, "Anybody want a pair?" And they were all over me and they were angry when I only had a half a dozen of them. They were great. Not that I don't love my daughter, but a lot of the music was very, very loud and not my taste. But
for a different audience, singer Amy Winehouse has been reported dead of an overdose.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, we'll have to see if that's actually true. There's a lot of that goes around, a lot of rumor that isn't true.
The police say they found a body in her flat, but it hasn't been identified as her yet.
She should be pretty obvious if it is her.
Well, they have to do next of kin notifications and official identification. But
well, that is kind of sad if it is true. That is sad. But, yeah, so be very careful of your computer and all the things that it does. Oh, I have a – oh, you're going to love this story. An iPhone-based device will soon let police forces identify within seconds a suspect based on facial features, fingerprints, or now the unique features of the human eye. The blocky device, called the Mobile Offender Recognition and Information System, or MORIS, attaches to the back of an Apple iPhone. To use the iris scan, the police officer holds the phone's camera about 6 inches from the suspect's face and snaps a close-up of the eye. The software analyzes over 200 unique features, and if the suspect's scan is already in a database, an algorithm matches them and identifies the suspect. The database is maintained by the vendor, B12 Technologies of Plymouth, Massachusetts. To use facial recognition, the officer snaps a photo from 2 to 5 feet away. Using software from Animatrics, MORIS analyzes over 100 unique facial features, compares them to similar scans in the database. There's also an integrated fingerprint scanner, so it's now NCIS actually works. MORIS is a mobile version of B12's original and still existing product, Iris, which was designed to run an iris scan on the prisoners being discharged from jail to confirm the right person was being released. The central database is key to the product. Those people who are talking about privacy problems say, look, you got to do it like 3 inches from their face. It's not like it's going to happen from a quarter mile away. So it's not quite the same thing. Listen, we're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, the great Linda Wildman, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 40 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1. It was not as nice as the music we were listening to. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Linda Wildman.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And it is still hot out, and you still haven't turned off most of your computers. What is wrong with you? Oh, this is I love this story. A few years back, GE... Oh, you can give us a call, by the way, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free 1-800-790-0415. A few years back, GE developed a new micro-holographic technique capable of burning 500 gigabytes, 500 gigabytes, onto a DVD-sized disk. Now the company's technology research group has come up with an optical disc writer capable of recording data to that disc at the same speed as a Blu-ray.
And Blu-ray is currently 50 gigabytes, so this is a 10 times improvement.
Which means it's going to take 10 times as long to write as a Blu-ray, but the fact is you can do it.
Yep.
Unlike a current disc, which has just 4 layers at the surface area for data recording, a hologram disc contains 3-dimensional patterns that represent bits of information throughout the entire volume of the disc. The newly developed writer uses a laser set at the same wavelength as Blu-ray technology to erase parts of the holograms to encode the data. Burning happens at a rate of 4 to 5 megabytes per second, which is on par with Blu-ray. GE says the new writing technology will bring micro-holographic media one step closer to the commercial market, as the discs could be read and recorded on systems that are very similar to current tech. The writing system's similarity to Blu-ray might also make it so future micro-holographic players will be backwards compatible for playing older DVDs and Blu-rays. When GE first announced their micro-holographic technique, It might have seemed like the next step after Blu-ray, but with the shift towards streaming and digital software distribution, disc-based media may be on its way out. So the question to you is, do we want hard drive capacity on a DVD, or are physical media dead, man? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
It's interesting that GE is working on this. This is not sort of the kind of thing you'd think of from General Electric.
Yeah, I know it. Well, they've got a Skunk Works, just like a lot of other places had or still have. And so they're doing it. But
and that's, I've read that that's a big thing that's been lacking recently is just pure research, you know, research for research's own goals, not trying to do something specific for your company.
Yeah, we do a lot less of that than we used to.
Yeah.
As a nation, we do that a lot less than we used to. It's an interesting problem, really, because without that pure research, how do we even know, what's possible, and yet how do you afford that pure research? You just don't.
That's one of the dangers a lot of us are feeling about the conclusion of the space shuttle after 30 years, is that NASA is being downsized dramatically. The replacement for the Hubble, the James Webb Space Telescope, funding has been drastically cut, and the project is nearly canceled.
Yep.
That type of basic research, what are we going to end up with in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, it saddens me the space shuttle is done. America doesn't go to space anymore.
Yeah.
That's all we've turned it over to other countries. Let them do it, and we'll just go along for the ride,
well,
but we don't do it ourselves.
Yeah, between Apollo and shuttle, there was an 8-year gap. So let's try for less than that this time.
Yeah,
but we don't even have a plan on the drawing board.
We don't have a national will to do it. That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Well, we'll go off on a soapbox again for a minute. It's the sort of the fallacy of saying we don't need to spend money on space. We should spend money, on problems at home. But
right.
But how, the space spinoffs, how many things were designed for technology that are so ubiquitous today that, we couldn't think of doing anything without them.
Yep. All right. Our next caller is Joe from Cheektowaga, New York. Welcome, Joe. What do you know?
Well, to answer your question from before, yes, I'm kind of a little excited that Linus is bumping the version number on Linux up, to something major now. I kind of wonder, though, you stick 500 gigabytes in your hand on something the size of a current DVD or Blu-ray or something like that. Isn't data corruption a little susceptible, to just the finest scratch on the disk? I mean, how do they get around that?
Yeah, you got to be. Well, I suppose if it's holographic, they could be duplicating the data elsewhere, but that would cut down on the amount you'd store on that disk.
That's built into the optical disk standards now is data redundancy to survive smallish scratches.
Right.
And a lot of times the scratches you get on a disk are just on the surface layer, the plastic protection layer, and you can get different kits that fill in that scratch, and then the data underneath is still okay.
Right.
The problem we're seeing is that as disks are getting cheaper and cheaper, they're getting thinner and thinner, and that protective coating is getting thinner as well.
Right. Now, and you could very well be right, Joe. Does that mean we'll go back to the days when every disk comes with its own carrier? And you put the whole carrier drive?
I still want. I hate buying spindles of disks because I want the jewel case.
No, I meant those. It used to be that you got a drive in a carrier, kind of like the iOmega disks.
Yeah, even a floppy disk was in a
its
plastic
own carrier.
Carrier. Yeah,
exactly.
DVD RAM.
Yeah.
You know what? Absolutely. If you can read and write it fast enough, absolutely.
I mean, also speaking of fragility, doesn't the thought of somebody turning on their cell phone during flight somehow making the plane crash, doesn't that kind of make you nervous to fly?
Yeah, so that's what I said earlier. If my cell phone can hurt the plane, you should fix the plane before I get on it.
Yeah, there's a definite fundamental problem with the plane itself. The problem,
I
of course,
there's a fundamental problem with their ideas of how much damage a cell phone or a few cell phones can do. If you remember, if you've seen it, MythBusters did an episode of that.
Yeah.
They couldn't actually fly, but they went on to a plane with a cell transmitter, and they said, any change to the avionics? Nope. Yep. They're pretty well shielded,
They tried to do the one where the cell phone blew up a gas station.
Yeah.
They had a room filled with gasoline vapor. They could not make it explode.
Right.
So then they threw some black powder in it, and it exploded real nice.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I love the Mythbusters. I really do. Yep. Jamie want big boom. Exactly. Exactly. But, yeah, and when in doubt, C4.
Yep.
I've always believed in that. But, yeah, the reality is that it shouldn't cause a problem. And the cabin should be shielded. Of course, the problem is that every ounce of shielding is more weight that you have to carry, and more weight that the plane, more fuel that the plane is going to burn up, which means more cost per flight, which means your airline ticket either is worth less money to the airline or they have to charge you more to cover the cost. Yeah,
you should switch over to optical cable, which shouldn't be susceptible to electromagnetic interference.
They are using optical cable. I mean, they'd be silly not to. Although, again, that costs more money because of the optical terminals at the other end.
Initial cost is higher, but life should be lower.
Yep.
Thanks. Nice chatting with you, folks.
Nice chatting with you, Joe. Thanks. And you, too, of course, can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. You know, for backup, half a terabyte might not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
But I haven't done the math yet. At four, let's call it at the low end, 4 megabytes per second. You know, how long is it going to take to back up 500 gig?
Yeah.
And nobody backs up, you know, in a server room, 500 gigs is a nice day.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we've got terabytes and terabytes of data, particularly from some of our users who mail entire books that they're writing back and forth, and you know who you are. So, when we've got 2.5-3 terabytes worth of data, 500 gig is like, yeah, so what?
We have this sort of discussion every few years, though. We had the 1 megabyte floppy, and we started, you know, coming out with 100 megabyte hard drives. Well, that's 100 floppies. And then 1 gigabyte hard drive, 1 terabyte hard drives, and they're just getting bigger and bigger. Now, the North Carolina data center that Apple's working on, they have 13 petabytes.
Yep.
13,000 terabytes. The company they bought the hard drives from claimed it in their quarterly report. We sold 13,000 1-terabyte hard drives to Apple.
Yeah. We had request for quotation, out for backup. And we talked to one company, and they said, you know, how much data do you have? And we said, well, about 3 terabytes. They said, oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're small potatoes compared to a lot of you guys. But, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, they look at huge amounts of data. And, of course, moving them over a network, if you're talking about offsite storage, very, very costly, can be. But even for the home user, you know, I mentioned this last week. Took my daughter to the Harry Potter premiere at midnight. Because apparently I'm an idiot.
I
was still paying
for
it. I was still paying for it Monday afternoon. Are you kidding? I'm not. I don't bounce back like I did when I was 20. I know that's a shocker. Certainly shocked me. Anyway, casual magic happened. I took a picture on the tablet. I took a picture of my daughter. Set the tablet down. Turned to the computer. The picture was already in Picasa.
Yep.
I hit one button and it was published to Google+. Now, that certainly used a lot of my data, and if I were taking 50, 60 pictures of a party, that's a lot of data going up to the network. I would probably turn off automatic upload.
Yeah.
But the point is, I then had that picture immediately in two places, on my tablet and on the web, which mitigates the problem, for example, one of our earlier callers had. Chris trying to send a picture very slow on 3G. I was, of course, on my wireless network, so that was much more expensive. Or Lou, who had the problem with the power going out and all the his wife's pictures were not backed up. So the ability to automatically back those up, but it still takes a lot of bandwidth to do that, particularly if you're not starting from scratch. You know, for example, if I take 50 pictures at a party, but then don't take any for a week or two, or a month or two, you know, if I only take them at parties or whatever, it's a lot less data usage.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot less of a problem. But, you know, we're really going to have to rethink how we use the internet if we're going to be constrained every time we try. And I realize, you know, these guys have a right to make money. We have a right to walk away and find somebody who doesn't charge us as much. I get all of that, but it really is going to come down at some point to the users versus the companies. And I really hate to see that, but I think we're going to see it. All right. Anyway, Linda's giving me the stink eye here and telling me we're done for another week. She's tough. So we'll be back next week with Dave Enright, I think, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco. Linda Wildman did a magnificent job keeping us in line today. It's 55 minutes after the hour. George is going to be brilliant, so you stay tuned for German music. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.